Yeah. Okay, we have just a tremendous amount of material to cover this morning in what is absolutely the most famous sermon that has ever been preached. What is the most famous sermon that's ever been preached? The Sermon on the Mount. It's got its own title there. Now, last week we introduced this with slides of the area there. This is a map I did not show last week, but again, just to get ourselves oriented. This is the Sea of Galilee, of course. I like this particular map because they show Gadara down here and the country of the Gadarenes. This is where that very famous demoniac is going to be healed, you know, demons cast out there. And then it also shows the plain of Gennesaret, very flat and fertile soil right there. These two areas are not often shown, you know, in all the maps right there, but they are prominent in Jesus' life. And then Capernaum, of course, is the city that he has adopted as his hometown and base of operations for what would be most of the 3.5 years that he is preaching. Jordan River, of course, coming into the Sea of Galilee right there at the top. And this Tiberias is the biggest city in the time of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee and is the biggest city to this day as well. The lake itself is surprisingly large. Doesn't look like it really, you know, on the satellite maps, for instance, but it's 7.5 miles wide at the widest point. It's about 13 miles long, again, at the widest point right there. So it's a very significant body of water. It certainly can generate some really serious storms. We'll be seeing miracles, you know, involved with that as well. This, of course, is just Google Earth and how it looks today. So the country, the Gadarenes down here, is now, you know, disputed territory in Israel between the Syrians and kind of a demilitarized zone right there. This border is Jordan itself, and this is Syria. So you've got these three nations coming together, and all of them have been having problems for how long? It's a new thing. It's just since New Testament times. No, the problems that we've been having with those people in that area, of course, go way back deep into the Old Testament as we've been studying in our chronological studies as well. And then here, all this white area is Tiberias. You can see it's a very significant city today. And then here's your plain of Gennesaret right there where so much of the farming would be taking place. All right, so as we get ready to look at the sermon itself, again last week I showed you some various photographs, tried to have different ones each day, but here's a typical group of tourists who have decided to walk up the hill that we think is the most likely location for the Sermon on the Mount. There's been a couple of other contenders there. You know, Jesus did not paint his name on a rock and leave it and say, here, I did this thing. So we looked at the biblical evidence, and this seems to fit the circumstances, but in verse 14, in chapter 5 of Matthew, just a moment, we'll be having that famous statement about a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Well, particularly in this shot, you can see how prominent Tiberias is set on the hill. So day or night, you should be able, you know, to look right across and see the city that's set on a hill from this particular location. It's the visual aid, I suppose, as Jesus is preaching this sermon. The Catholic Church, for a order of nuns back in 1938, built this chapel structure right here. If we go back to the preceding photo, please notice this bush right here, and then the netting that they use today to cover what are banana groves. And then from the helicopter view, all those people were standing right behind this cupola here, you know, on this trail that goes through, and then, of course, it's the bananas. So they were just below what is really the top of that hill. All right, that being the case, let's come on over now. And here are the things that Jesus presented, apparently, on this hillside, and what is the perfect location to gather thousands of people and present this sermon. So we're going to start, though, if you have the harmony, with the right-hand column, because in Luke chapter 6, we also have what is an account of this same event. Now, Matthew's account is very much larger. He devotes 3 full chapters to the Sermon on the Mount. We'll spend most of our time with Matthew's account. But let's lead off with chapter 6 in the book of Luke at verse 17. He descended with them. The them are the apostles who have just been selected. The last thing that we studied last week, Jesus went up on a mountain slash hill. He prayed all night. He then selected 12 men to be the apostles. They were going to be spending a great deal more time with him than the other disciples, of which there are thousands and thousands now. Many people are devoted to him that are studying what he has to say. But these apostles, of course, are also going to be charged with very specific missions and responsibilities. They will also, therefore, have the power to be working miracles. So it's at this same, the night before the Sermon on the Mount, same time frame, that he has selected those men. And then, come the next day, the first thing they're going to see him do in their new official capacity is what they will spend the rest of their lives doing: preaching the gospel wherever they'll be sent into all the world. So he descended with them, came down from his selection, stood on a level place. There was a great multitude of his disciples and a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon. This is a huge assembly on this particular occasion. There's a large number, multitudes of disciples. The Greek term, mathetes, disciple, means student or learner, but it carries with it the idea of follower, somebody who's not just interested in doing some reading or listening to some sermons, but is devoted to this individual, spending a lot of time, you know, trying to soak up what they have to teach. So we've got huge numbers of them. And then we have this great throng, and by the way, if you're looking at the harmony side by side, you'll see that only Luke tells us about, first, the great multitude of disciples, and then the great throng of those that are just from surrounding regions. Judea, Jerusalem, Tyre, and Sidon, they're not disciples, they're not apostles, they're just curious, they're just interested. So, there are multiple thousands of people here for sure. Other occasions, we'll get numbers on these multitudes. We'll have Jesus feeding 5,000 at one time, 4,000 at another. Number is not given on this occasion. But this most famous of sermons was probably presented to one of, if not the largest group of people that Jesus ever meets at one time. It comes from a huge region all the way down as far as Jerusalem. There are people who are not disciples that are described as a great throng, and then multitudes of the disciples as well. This is a perfect location then for such a scene. However, I might just point out that you can also see the city of Tiberias, so not quite so prominently, from the top of Mount Arbel right there. And some do argue that perhaps the sermon actually was preached over on top of that mountain. I doubt it, because you can see from the photograph, it's a lot more difficult to access for all the people coming from the region where Jesus has been doing most of his work anyway. That would be a very arduous, even dangerous thing to try to do. But if in fact you're coming from Tiberias, which is the largest city at the time, it's a rather gentle walk up this slope, and there's a huge area that is very flat up on the top of Mount Arbel. We don't know where it took place, whether that location or the other, just in the immediate area. And with these ginormous numbers then, it says in verse 18 of Luke 6, they had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases, which Matthew didn't tell us. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were being cured. Matthew didn't mention that point in his beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. In verse 19 in Luke, and all the multitude were trying to touch him, for power was coming from him and healing them all. Again, very interesting that Luke adds these little pieces. We're on the next page now, the harmony. Then you can see the Matthew column is blank. This, brethren, began with the most significant event of choosing the 12. As it unfolds, you can imagine, is a scene of pandemonium at the start. We have thousands and thousands of people, judging by the numbers that are assigned to words like multitudes in other places. But
they're bringing to him all the sickness that's in all this area so that he can be healed. And they have discovered that just touching him can result in a healing. There'll be more on that in another event, the famous hem of the garment statement. So you don't need to engage Jesus in a conversation. Now, if you can imagine thousands and thousands of people from a very wide area who are bringing all of those that are sick in a very wide area, you have a lot of people to begin with. But what are all the sick ones trying to do? They're actually trying to get to him. So the crush of it and the urgency of it, you know, must have been really impressive. So at some point, with all of what I imagine is just all this jostling going on, you know, just kind of a mob here that's very excited. Imagine the shouts of joy as person after person gets healed. You know, they're trying to work their way out so other people can get in. It would just be very intense, very loud, very energetic, very joyful. At some point, Jesus is going to settle that crowd down now. Did Jesus come to this earth so that he can eliminate hospitals? No. Did he come to do away with all disease? No. What is the purpose of the miracle? Numerous places in Scripture tell us, at least three specifically, what is the purpose of a miracle? It is to confirm the Word. Okay? I'm going for the actual scriptural reference, but to confirm the Word. So what do the miracles do? Draw the crowd for what is a far more important purpose. What's the far more important purpose? The sermon, the material that Jesus wants these people to understand. So then, that being the case, on page 64, we now move over to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 3 and begin with the Beatitudes. Now, remember, always, and this is one of the numerous advantages of this book, no gospel writer, I don't suppose, and there's four of them telling the story of the life of Christ, ever records everything that happens on any given event. So you will find that Luke's Beatitudes, as we call them, the word that means blessed, so blessed are, this opening preamble introduction to this lengthy sermon is somewhat different. I'm not going to point out all those differences, but you've got the two columns now. Have a look there. I'm going to start with Matthew, but you'll notice significant differences, additional information, other things that Jesus said, elaborations upon individual Beatitudes. So much more full than just Matthew. But in the world today, if you say Sermon on the Mount, where does everybody go? Matthew 5. Why? Three chapters are devoted to it. But Luke's account, very, very helpful in filling in some gaps on additional things. Verse 3 of Matthew 5, the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are, you'll notice the New American Standard translates it gentle in the harmony. Meek, of course, is the King James, which everybody remembers. But blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Meek does not mean milk toast. Meek does not mean weak. Meek does not mean shy and retiring. It means disciplined and gentle. You're controlling yourself. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, if you'll just skip over to verse 22 in the Luke column. Blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you and cast insults at you and spurn your name as evil
for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day. Leap for joy. For behold, your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way your fathers used to treat the prophets. But woe to those who are rich, for you are receiving your comfort in full. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets. Now, as we finish the Beatitudes, what does Luke tell us that Jesus adds that Matthew never even mentions? What is the opposite of a blessed are? Woe is you. Jesus had a left hand and a right. He had a balance here. He had a positive and a negative beginning to this sermon. And both are equally important, of course. But as we've just read through them, and I'm trying to get through two whole chapters of the three in this sermon this morning, so we didn't have a lot of time for this. But as you look at this, and as you're studying later, do you see now, after my introduction, how very much more powerful it is? If you see the pandemonium of the crowd, all the energy and excitement, imagine the joy of these many, many people being healed. And Jesus talks about joy in the Beatitudes. But he also wants them to rejoice, not just in physical healings, but in what else?
Suffering.
Okay. He is trying to explain to them that there are times to rejoice. For instance, this time easier to find me before he's looking Matthew's column at the last verse there. It's Matthew 5:12. Rejoice and be glad. Well, what's everybody been doing? For your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Rejoice and be glad what in verse 11? When you're persecuted, when you're insulted, when you're mocked. See, you know, that's pretty powerful. When these people have been demonstrating, they really know how to rejoice. I rejoice too. If all my physical ills just went away. I have a whole lot of them, but I'd sure like to get rid of this heartburn thing that's been troubling me for years. That's what I can see getting done real soon. And I'd be happy about it. But, you know, heal the lame and every other disease that they have. Now he says, is that the thing to be rejoicing about? No, because on the spiritual side of things, what you believe about Jesus, that is going to bring the hatred of the world down upon you. You cannot be a dedicated disciple of Jesus the Christ and not have people get mad at you. They don't like that moral standard. They don't want to be pointed out as sinful. They don't want to hear that they have only one way to heaven, Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father except through Him. If you're going to be serious about your discipleship, then people are going to be after you, for sure. And when they turn on you, when they insult you, when they mock you, when they harm you physically, when they burn your house to the ground, when they threaten your wife and children, then what should you do? Rejoice. Why? Because, brethren, you are proving that you get what is of real importance. And it isn't the physical stuff in the world. It isn't a good, strong, healthy body. It is righteousness. It is all of the things that he's mentioned in these Beatitudes. Be poor in spirit, be mourning, be gentle, hunger and thirst for righteousness, be merciful, pure in heart, and a peacemaker. Do those things, and you'll be persecuted. So now you can rejoice. You know, seriously rejoice, because your name is written in heaven. So, there in the Beatitudes, along with the woe to yous, at the beginning of the sermon. Got everybody's attention now? You think Jesus has? They may have had, brethren, hours of healings going on before he makes this bold and great contrast. Here's what to really value. Here's what to really appreciate. Then, and now if you look at the harmony, you'll see at the bottom of page 64, all of page 65, more than half of page 66. Who's the only gospel writer now that is telling us about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, that's why everybody goes to Matthew. There's a great deal of information that isn't recorded anywhere else. Now, before we launch into this, let me say just one other thing. Is this the only time that Jesus preaches this sermon? No. You'll find aspects of it in other locations. Most likely, every, you know, very distinct, unique, and farther away kind of an area that Jesus gets to, or separate from the last town he was in, I imagine he would just preach that same sermon over again. He wants everybody to get these principles. So Matthew's going to give them to us. We're now in Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, at the bottom of page 64. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It's good for nothing anymore, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do men light a lamp and put it under the peck measure, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, I counted properly there. I think we got three you's and one your. To whom is Jesus speaking when he says you? How many Christians are in the audience? Well, there's none. When will we have Christianity? 3 years from now. Now, there may be some mixed into this audience of Gentiles, but it'd be few. And, you know, the miracles and the healings, that's going to draw some people, and we know it did. But when he says, you, who's he talking to that's the great majority of this audience? Jews. Are they still offering animal sacrifices? Are they still required to keep, you know, all the feasts? Do they still have to rest on the Sabbath every, seventh day of the week? Well, sure. Now, brethren, this is going to be critically important to me. I've only got one other chart here to show you in a minute. I think one of the absolutely most gigantic mistakes that we make commonly in the Sermon on the Mount, and that's us in this room and everybody else, is that we just kind of drop in out of the sky and we say, oh, Jesus is talking to me. Now, I ought to be careful here. These things were recorded in that gospel so they could get to you. That's true. But if you go back in time and think about what's being said here, whatever you get out of this sermon, you should at least get the same thing out of it as the people that he gave it to. The people that he gave it to don't live 2,000 years later. The people he gave it to haven't been familiar with Christianity every generation before him for 2 millennia. The people that he spoke to were Jews still living under what? Moses' law. Did Jesus want them to stop offering the sacrifices, quit doing Passover and Pentecost? No, he's not calling on them to do anything. So whatever you get out of this sermon, you just always remember that those people who were on that hill, every one of them a Jew, who's going to be a Jew for 3 more years, they could understand and apply this sermon. That sermon was for them then. Paul will be the apostle to the Gentiles. But this sermon is for those people at that period of time. So, who were the salt of the earth? The Jews. Who were the light of the world? The Jews. Christianity won't exist for 3 years. It isn't going to take shape in anybody's mind for 3 more years. The Jews were the salt of the earth. The Jews were the light of the world.
those people at that time under their old covenant keeping Moses' law, they were just as much the salt of the earth and the light of the world as we often think of ourselves as being. And we are the salt of the earth. We are the light of the world. But so were they. Now, I make a giant point out of this, and you're wondering, wow, for a guy who wants to cover two chapters, you know, a lot of time here, because of what is on the top of page 65. Some of the most misunderstood verses in all the Bible, I think. In verse 17, after saying, you are the light of the world, salt of the earth, he then says to them, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from what? What law? Moses' law, the Torah, the Old Testament, until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of what commandments? The Ten Commandments and the thousand more that God gave to Moses, to all the commandments of the Old Covenant, the Jewish commandments. Whoever annuls one of the least of those commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in what? The kingdom of heaven. Now we have to be very careful, brethren. I think we've terribly misunderstood this sermon. You know, I know I did anyway. I think a lot of my brethren have. How many times have you heard the Sermon on the Mount is the Christian Constitution? Boy, that rings great. That's a terrific phrase, isn't it? Is it? No. It's not the Christian Constitution unless everybody he's talking to is what? Christians. He's talking about the law to people who are under the law. He is telling these people under the law, I'm not here to abolish the law. And if you teach that you should, then you people now, in this time frame, you'd be least in the kingdom. He is not changing the law at all in any way to these people who won't dream of being Christians for three more years. I did not come to abolish the law or the prophets. And then he ends up with verse 20, for I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Doesn't that suggest they're not in the kingdom of heaven yet? They'll be least in it if they don't understand this principle, though. And in order to get into that kingdom, their righteousness should be compared to whom in that last verse we just read? Scribes and Pharisees. Are those Christian offices? No, those are Jewish at the time. Okay? And what is he saying about righteousness? He is saying the scribes and Pharisees have it exactly right. Be like them. Yes or no? Check the box that says no. He said in verse 20, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus has a beef with the scribes and Pharisees whose righteousness is so low and so inadequate, they can't even get into the kingdom. What will you need to do if you want to get into the kingdom? Do better than they did. But at this point on that hill, do better than the scribes and Pharisees in what? Keeping the law of Moses. They were denying it. They were breaking it. They were abusing it. Jesus is correcting their abuse of that law. So look again at verse 17. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. There's no way he's standing on that hill. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Brethren, how do you fulfill a law? You obey it. You keep it. What law did Jesus say he is standing there right now fulfilling? Moses' law. What is he saying to these people he wants them to understand about him? Is he a destroyer of law for them in the next 3 years? Or is he a fulfiller, a keeper, and a doer of the law? He's doing it right. Who's doing it wrong? The scribes and Pharisees. So when the sermon starts, blessed are you, woe is you. Now let me get this straight at the outset. I did not come to abolish the law. Don't you think that? I came to fulfill it. Then we start in on what will be six contrasts. You've heard, but I say. Brethren, in my view, you think about this. It's my conviction. Most people, in or out of the Lord's church, completely misunderstand what Jesus is doing here. You've heard, but I say. Why, it's a Christian constitution. You've heard Moses' law, but I'm telling you I'm bigger than that. I'm better than that. And I'm setting that aside, and I'm giving you a new law and a higher law. I am elevating this to something beyond anything that Moses ever said, is the way most people read these six contrasts. Is that right? Not if verses 17 through 20 are true. That's not right at all. Especially verse 20. You've heard that it was said, from whom? Scribes and Pharisees. Who? Are keeping the law or are not? Are not. Whose righteousness is good or substandard? Substandard. What Jesus now sets out to do with these six comparisons is to teach these Jews under the law, 3 years before Christianity, having just stipulated that he is not abolishing the law, and he's not going to teach that anybody should, he is about to give them six comparisons between the abuse, misuse, and failure of the scribes and Pharisees to keep the law. But I say unto you, Jesus declares, what Moses said and what Moses meant. The contrast is not between the old law and the new law. It is not between Moses and Christ. It is not between a lower law and a higher law. The contrast is between the failure of the scribes and Pharisees to teach and keep the law and the way you're supposed to teach and keep the law. Jesus is affirming Moses, confirming Moses, explaining Moses, elaborating upon Moses. These six contrasts tell you what those Jews were supposed to get out of Moses' law. But what do most people teach? It's been very popular for a while. It's a Christian constitution. It's Jesus setting Moses' law aside. What had he just said in verses 17 to 20? I am not going to do that. So, look at the chart here for just a minute. I'm going to build a chart here very rapidly on a single slide that has very little scriptures on it on the right-hand side because there just wasn't room to do it. But what I want to show you is this. In Matthew 5 and verses 21 through 26, Jesus talks about anger and what they've heard about anger. Now, there's quotations directly from the Old Testament, and then there's an understanding of how the scribes and Pharisees had misused it. What Jesus then does is explain Moses' law, how those scribes and Pharisees should have taught it, and how these Jews ought to keep it. Let me ask you, brother, from Genesis 4 on, what did you learn that anger could lead to? Murder. Is just murder wrong? We don't have time to do it this morning. We're doing an overview. I really would like you to go back, read Genesis 4, and think about the things that are actually said there. And if it isn't the anger that started the whole problem and the anger that is being condemned. Why are you angry? God asks Cain after he's killed his brother. So brethren, this isn't new information about anger. The Old Testament's been teaching this since Genesis. In my Bible's margin, I think I've got eight passages about anger from just the Proverbs that I wrote in my Bible. Verses 27 through 30 is about lust. Now, we all understand, under the old law, you couldn't commit adultery, but lust was just fine, right? But I say unto you, so Jesus is going to elevate this and say, no, the lust is wrong too. So Jesus brings us a new law that Moses never said.
Brethren, what does Exodus 20, verse 17 say? Thou shalt not what? Covet your neighbor's wife. What is that? Lust. Certainly the Old Testament taught this. But the scribes and Pharisees didn't. They taught, this is no problem, just go commit adultery. No. From the beginning, Moses was forbidding that lust. That's not the case at all. Jesus is contrasting their failure to keep the law with how they were supposed to keep the law. He is not setting the old law aside. Verses 31 and 32 are about divorce. We all understand, didn't he divorce anybody, you know, it's time to honor the old law. But under the new law, Jesus is going to change that. He's going to raise that. No, that's a bunch of hogwash, brethren. Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, teaches precisely, exactly, identically what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. It's just Pharisees weren't keeping it. What were they doing when it came to divorce? Well, he's casting off the wives everywhere. What's Matthew 19 about? Them coming to argue for that. Okay? Jesus is contrasting their abuse of the old law with the proper understanding of the old law. There isn't any new or different law here, but the one every one of those Jews already knew. Verses 33 through 37 is about the vows. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 5 through 7 teaches the same thing. 38 through 42 in the Sermon on the Mount is about vengeance, not a good thing, as is Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18, saying exactly the same thing. Verses 43 through 48, we've got six of these contrasts, that's the last, teaches you to love your enemy. Now, of course, the Old Testament never taught that, did it? So Jesus says, but I say unto you, so I'm going to give you a new law, and now I'm going to require that you have to love your enemy, but under Moses' law, nobody ever did. Is that true? Brethren, that is just utterly false. Utterly false. And again in Leviticus 19, now verse 17 and 18, it quite specifically tells you to love whom? Your enemy. Okay? So, do I look exercised about this morning? Brethren, this is the Sermon on the Mount. It's the most famous sermon in history. There's three chapters on it. And from the start, virtually everybody gets it wrong. And they say, what Jesus is doing in six contrasts is saying, here's Moses' law, but I say to you something new, different, you never heard before, that's higher and better. Which would make him be doing what to Moses' law? Abolishing it. When he had just said he wasn't. What is he doing with Moses' law? Fulfilling it. Everything in these contrasts, but I say to you, is the fulfillment of what law? Moses' law. Okay? Now I have to leave it to you to go study through those. There's the chart. There's some references. Now hopefully you'll start doing some study of your own. And brethren, you are going to find these six things in Matthew 5 all over your Old Testament. They're everywhere in the Old Testament. Not one word of this was new. It's just that nobody under the teaching of these scribes and Pharisees was being taught this, and a lot of people consequently weren't practicing it either. So that brings us then down to, let's just take page 66, and we'll start with the summary here, which is the sixth of these six contrasts. We're on page 66 in the left-hand column. It'll be Matthew 5 and verse 43. You've heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, why are the words you shall love your neighbor capitalized? Because that's the New American Standard Convention for telling you this is the quotation from the Old Testament. Now look at the phrase, and hate your enemy. What do you notice about that? Any place in the Old Testament taught you could hate your enemy? No, what did the Pharisees teach in practice? 44, but I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, which is precisely what Leviticus 19, verses 17 and 18 says. In order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? Matthew must have kind of winced under that one. And if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Gentiles, brethren, are not Jews. This is a contrast, brethren, between Moses' law being properly kept or not, and the Gentiles. Prove it. Reference the Gentiles. Are there Gentiles in Christianity now? No. This is all Old Testament. But in verse 48, brethren, therefore you are to be what? Perfect, as your Heavenly Father is perfect, which we will find also taught in the New Testament. So my saying, throw the Sermon on the Mount away, it doesn't matter anymore. Now we've learned, you know, it's for the Jews only, and so we don't need it. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm just saying that if you get anything out of that sermon that a practicing Jew under Moses' law could not get and practice under that law, then you've missed the point of what Jesus was doing. He was teaching Jews how to be Jews under the Jewish law, which they would live under for 3 more years. Matthew chapter 6, page 67. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven, and therefore you give alms. Do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the what? The Jewish synagogues and in the streets, that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give alms, let your left hand not know what your right hand is doing, that your alms may be in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will repay you. And when you pray, not going to be as a hypocrite. They love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners in order to be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. In other words, what is the entirety of their reward? Being seen by men. I'd kind of rather go to heaven, wouldn't you? Yeah. So my righteousness needs to what? Exceed their righteousness if I'm ever to enter the kingdom. 6. But you, when you pray, go into your inner rooms. When you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will repay you. When you're praying, don't use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do. They suppose they'll be heard for their many words. Therefore, do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask Him. So He gives us a model prayer that Jews could pray. Pray then in this way. Our Father who is in heaven, holy be your name, hallowed, we don't use so much anymore. Thy kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Can a Jew pray that prayer? Yes. Okay? And now that the kingdom has come, something they were looking forward to, brethren, we're going to pray. We're going to do the things Jesus has suggested here because we find them in the other books of the New Testament. But I'm not praying for the kingdom to come anymore, seeing that it already has. Now, in verse 14, if you forgive men for their transgressions, your Heavenly Father will also forgive you. If you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. And whenever you fast, fasting at least one day out of the year was required of the Jews, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do. They neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, so that you may not be seen fasting by men, but by your Father who is in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will repay you. Is there fasting for Christians in the New Testament later? Yes. Here's sound advice I can follow, but if I get something out of this sermon that those Jews could not practice, I've missed the point of the sermon. We'll close with the last verses of chapter 6, there to the bottom of page 68. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in or steal, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. Therefore the light that is in you is darkness. How great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, He will either hate the one and love the other, or he'll hold the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. For this reason I say to you, do not be anxious for your life as to what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor for your body as to what you shall put on. Is not life more than food and the body than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single cubit to his lifespan? And why are you anxious about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory did not clothe himself like one of these. But if God so raised the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more do for you, O men of little faith? Do not be anxious then, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? With what shall we clothe ourselves? All these things the Gentiles eagerly seek. For your heavenly Father knows you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, do not be anxious for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of his own. Those last words, are they just as true today as they were then?
Yes.
Sure. How do we know that? Host of other passages. All I've said this morning, these first two chapters, is please don't pitch the Jews out of the boat. The sermon was for them, and they could keep every word in it. Read over a minute or two. Thank you for your kindness and patience. Class is